I'm George Samueli. I'm the author of the definitive history of the wars of the Balkans of the 1990s, Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War in Yugoslavia. I'm a fellow of the Global Policy Institute of London, and I'm currently residing in Budapest, Hungary.
Let's just start with the Balkans, because it seems unfinished business of NATO's there. Serbia still seems to be quite an independent state.
No, that's right. It is unfinished business as far as NATO is concerned. They agreed, in the case of Bosnia and Herzegovina, to a federal system, which, and therefore kind of a bifurcated form of government. It was split up into a Republika Srpska, which was dominated by the Serbs of Bosnia, and into a Muslim Croat Federation. But this is very displeasing to NATO, because NATO really wanted a unitary state of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and in fact really just fought for it through the sort of early 1990s to achieve that. They weren't able to achieve that, so they had to settle for this compromise. But as a result, Bosnia and Herzegovina cannot be inducted into NATO. Because while the Muslim Croat Federation would be very happy and indeed would welcome membership of NATO, the Republika Srpska is absolutely adamant about not joining NATO. So Bosnia and Herzegovina stays outside NATO, but it's ruled over by something called the Office of the High Representative, who is appointed largely by the NATO powers. It's invariably either an Austrian or a German, and they are invariably extraordinarily hostile to the Republika Srpska, so much so that they're continually threatening to take action against the Republika Srpska, arresting the president of the Republika Srpska. And so that remains unfinished business, as is the case of Serbia proper, which is also maintaining an independent foreign policy, staying outside of NATO. And while it wants to join the European Union, it isn't prepared to pay the price expected, which is, first of all, to recognize the theft of Kosovo, because basically the NATO powers stole Kosovo from Serbia. So Serbia is not prepared to accept the independence of Kosovo, and Serbia is not prepared to go against Russia and join the EU and the NATO powers in imposing sanctions against Russia. So Serbia is just there. It's a sore point for NATO and the EU. However, they also need Serbia, because it's of the countries in the Balkans, it is the biggest, and therefore it is economically the most significant. So while North Macedonia is a member of NATO, but not of the EU, Montenegro, member of NATO, but not of the EU, Albania, also a member of NATO, but not of the EU, they're all there, but ultimately Serbia is still the most powerful of those countries. So it's just a matter of annoyance for NATO and the EU that Serbia defies them, and yet Serbia remains the strongest power in the Balkans.
Now, I may be wrong, but isn't Kosovo still a kind of niggling issue? I mean, this is where some say that the whole Yugoslav conflict after the death of Tito and NATO's intervention there, the Kosovo Liberation Army, the separatists in Kosovo, who goodness knows where they got their guns, but that sort of, isn't it still a bit of a running sore with the Serbs?
It's very much a running sore. The Serbs refuse to accept the loss of Kosovo. They regard Kosovo as really the birth of Serbia. It's their spiritual home. You know, it's filled with Orthodox churches and Orthodox monasteries. Kosovo was taken from them following the 1999 NATO bombing. The problem for the NATO powers and the EU powers with Kosovo is they're not able to maintain a united front, because there are some NATO powers that also refuse to recognize the independence of Kosovo. Slovakia, refuses to accept, recognize the independence of Kosovo. But more significantly, so does Spain. And you know, Spain is a more is actually a major power in Europe. But Spain, obviously, with its own secessionist issues, just absolutely refuses to recognize the principle of unilateral secession, which is what Kosovo did in 2008. It declared independence of Serbia, and then the NATO powers immediately rushed in to recognize it.
Now, but, you see, I'm thinking about Catalonia.
Exactly.
Maybe that's why the Spanish are a little bit concerned. I mean, it's almost like us in Bristol suddenly putting up checkpoints on the motorways and saying Bristol is now independent.
Yeah, exactly. And that's right. And that's the real sore point with Spain. I mean, it's the same with Slovakia. I mean, Slovakia has a very large Hungarian population, as does Romania. And so they don't want to establish the principle that unilateral secession is the way to go. And that's what it was in the case of Kosovo. It was unilateral secession. The NATO powers, the key NATO powers, America, Britain, France, they have no principles. They just act entirely according to their geopolitical interests. You know, they don't care at all about consistency. But for countries that do have serious secessionist issues, they can't stomach it. So that's really the problem for NATO and the EU, because NATO could then just simply say, okay, we're going to bring Kosovo into NATO. You know, we don't really care whether Serbia recognizes it or not. What do we care about Serbia? But they're not able to do it because they know that, you know, that they have to get unanimity within NATO to get to induct new members. And then there's no way that they can get that on Kosovo.
Just staying with former Yugoslavia, the Croatians have gone over to the euro. Everything seems to be being slowly subsumed into NATO and the EU. How is it, do you think, that NATO, I mean, obviously it can't 100%, but it seems to have quite a lot of leverage with any governments that join NATO as to their security policy and foreign policy. How does that work?
Well, they maintain that absolute unanimity in the bloc. The one outlier, well, there are basically two outliers, which is Turkey and Hungary. And you notice when they brought in Finland and Sweden in 2022-2023, pretty much everybody immediately said, yep, that's it. You know, we accept Sweden and Finland as new NATO members. They couldn't care less whether it actually does it do anything to enhance NATO members' security. But the two outliers were Hungary and Turkey. But of those two, Hungary was the only one that actually raised the question that does this do anything to enhance NATO security. Turkey was only preoccupied with Sweden's sympathetic treatment of Kurdish fighters. You know, the PKK members had sought sanctuary in Sweden, and Turkey was really angry about that and wanted Sweden to make some concessions. So Turkey didn't raise any principled issue as to, you know, is this good or bad for NATO. Hungary did, but Hungary is really quite a small country. I mean, it's, you know, it basically can't go against 30 NATO member states. So once Turkey got some kind of assurances by Sweden that, okay, we definitely will not provide sanctuary to Kurdish terrorists, Turkey said, okay, fine, then we'll accept Sweden inside NATO. And at that moment, Hungary also caved and said, okay, well, we'll accept it as well. But Hungary was the last holdout. And interestingly, having done that, the other day, the Swedish prime minister attacked Hungary. He attacked Hungary for Prime Minister Viktor Orban's visit to Georgia. I guess maybe we'll talk about that later. And because Orban seemed to say, yep, this election is free and fair. We accept the result of this election. And this elicited this furious response from the Swedish prime minister saying, I don't know who Orban is speaking for. He doesn't speak for Europe. Maybe he speaks for Russia. And so that's Sweden's thank you to Hungary for Hungary finally accepting Sweden as a NATO member.
It's like herding cats, it must be, as NATO gets bigger and bigger. But they do have quite a lot of leverage, the military, over their foreign policy and their security policy. Okay, let's have a look at these recent referenda and elections in Eastern Europe. Now, can you just, we start with Moldova a couple of weeks ago. Whereabouts is Moldova and why is it politically significant which way they go?
Well, Moldova was a former republic of the USSR, and it has a very large Romanian population. And indeed, Romania regards Moldova as a part of Romania. It was a part of Romania between the wars. It was taken over by the Soviet Union in 1940. You know, during the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact era, so obviously then it kept it within the USSR after 1945. But the issue, however, with Moldova, very very small country, very very poor country, is that it also has regions there that are not Romanian and are actually almost entirely Russian, which is Transnistria. Now, the
Can we just say something about where it is? Because it's in the south of Ukraine.
It's kind of sandwiched between between Ukraine and Romania.
Does it have any ports on the Black Sea? Because it's right near that area.
Yeah, it's right near the area, but it doesn't actually have ports in the Black Sea. But it is part of it's obviously it's very close to Odessa, so that's
I think the map is interesting in situations like this because Ukraine seems to have somehow managed to get hold of the strip of land that's mm-hmm. in between Moldova and the Black Sea. You know, so
right.
Obviously at some point this place has been deliberately landlocked.
Yeah, it is, but the Moldova's importance is that although in the constitution it is, it maintains neutrality. Neutrality is written into the constitution. In other words, it's not a member of NATO. It cannot apply for NATO membership. However, throughout this, the Russia so-called special military operation, it has acted as a de facto NATO ally. And Moldova has been used as a transit route for weapon systems going from Romania into Ukraine. So it is a vital piece of real estate. It's part of the land bridge from Romania into Ukraine. And keep in mind, in Romania, the Americans are building their biggest military base in Europe. I mean, it's not in Germany anymore. It's in Romania, because Romania is that's a really vital piece of real estate. That's on the Black Sea. So if the Americans are building this huge military base in Romania, you can see how important Moldova is, because that's the transit route into Ukraine.
This recent referendum, apparently it was on a knife edge, and it's a little bit like some... We have these weird elections nowadays where lots of the polls... right or wrong, say one thing, and then slowly but surely on the night, things edge along. Apparently, it was an absolute whisker by which the European Union won this referendum and the Russians lost. So basically, I think, what was the actual question at stake? Because it was extremely finely balanced in the end, but the EU has apparently beaten the Russians here.
Well, you could say that the EU stole it. I mean, you're absolutely right. And what the issue wasn't so much whether Moldova would or would not be in the EU. It's not really up to Moldova anyway, or whether Moldova will or won't negotiate with the EU, because that's already ongoing. They wanted to make a constitutional change that in which Moldova's aspiration for EU membership would be enshrined in the constitution, so that it would be impossible for any future Moldovan leader to say, I don't think EU membership is for us. So that was the issue there, was that we're going to make a change to the constitution. But as you said, on the night, that anti-EU vote or anti-constitutional change vote was winning comfortably. It was 10 points ahead. You know, even when there were 90% of the votes were counted, the anti-EU vote was about 10% ahead. And then suddenly, as we sort of reached the sort of 95, 96, 97, 98% of the vote counted, suddenly that pro-EU vote prevailed. But the problem is that there was obviously a great deal of fraud taking place, because the largest Moldovan diaspora is in Russia. But the Moldovan government, this pro-NATO, pro-EU government of Moldova, only secured two polling stations in Russia. And moreover, there were only 5,000 ballot papers available in each of those two polling stations. So essentially, the Moldovan diaspora in Russia, who would probably have voted against the constitutional change, they were disenfranchised. So this was this result was a complete fraud. I mean, you know, there's no way that you can take it seriously when you know, we don't know the exact size of the Moldovan diaspora in Russia, but it's something of the order of 500,000. So if these people were disenfranchised, then that vote was meaningless.
But it's going to stand, surely. The constitution has changed, and the path is now set for Moldova to join the European Union.
Well, European Union membership, that's not on. Moldova's not going to join the EU. Moldova's too poor. And that's just, you know, a lot of hot air that the EU puts out, that somehow Ukraine will be in the EU, Moldova will be in the EU. No one's joining the EU. The only thing that matters for the Western powers is NATO. NATO membership is crucial. And that's what they want from Moldova. They want Moldova formally to abandon its stance of neutrality and therefore become this important piece of real estate. You know, in all this time, what has always mattered was NATO membership. It's always NATO membership comes first, then comes EU membership. Every single new member state of the EU first had to go through the process of joining NATO. And then they've now even abandoned that. So you now have many new NATO states who basically have no real hope of EU membership anytime in the future. And that's North Macedonia, Montenegro, Albania. There's no way that they're going to be joining the EU. They keep, you know, keep bringing it up. EU talks vaguely. Yeah, maybe someday. Who knows? But what was important was NATO membership. And that's the same thing with Moldova. What they want is a constitutional change in Moldova to make sure that Moldova is no longer neutral. And then they can induct Moldova into NATO. The problem they have there with in Moldova is that there are conflicts on Moldovan territory. I mean, there's obviously the issue of Transnistria, which is a kind of a Russian enclave in Moldova. So that would be a problem, getting Moldova into NATO, because it has to deal with that issue. There's also Gagauzia, which is largely Turkic population. They speak Russian there, but they're not at all well disposed towards the government. So they're essentially also they tend to vote against NATO there. So that's a drawback for the NATO lobby in Moldova.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, can you explain a little bit about these two enclaves? Because this, I didn't know about this at all. So not only have you got this kind of little country, Moldova, that didn't seem to quite fit with Romania or Ukraine, but you've also got these enclaves within Moldova, which are Russian leaning. What did you say it's called? One's Transnistria.
One is called Transnistria. Yeah, Transnistria, which is entirely Russian population. And there are Russian forces there. Russian forces there protecting the Russian population.
So
Moldova is continually demanding that the Russian forces leave, but the Russian forces are there protecting the Russian population.
And the other one's Gagauzia. Okay, but so do they also have soldiers there?
No, not in Gagauzia. Gagauzia is like that's a Turkic population, Turkic roots, but they speak Russian and they do tend to be quite pro-Russian. So that's another problem for them.
This Transnistria sounds a little bit like Kaliningrad or somewhere like that, where you've got
It's there. But Kaliningrad is of course a strategically significant. Whereas Transnistria, that's just simply a Russian population. It's not strategically that significant. From Russia's point of view, it's a little problem because Russia doesn't really have a border with Moldova. So that's why when this whole special military operation started, one thing that we had expected, at least I had expected, is that they would try to seek a land bridge through Ukraine to Transnistria so that if Transnistria ever came under attack, they would be able to move their forces quickly into Transnistria to protect the Russian population. But they don't, that doesn't seem to. So they would have to then take Odessa and the Black Sea coast in order to have that land bridge to Transnistria. But those Russians there are vulnerable. I mean, if Moldova decides to launch an attack under NATO auspices, Russia would have some difficulties immediately sending their forces to protect the Transnistrians.
Yeah, but on the other side, it's a bit niggling. I mean, we were talking about Kosovo earlier. It's niggling away at NATO, the fact that they've got these kind of Russian enclaves like Kaliningrad and Transnistria. They're sitting there. Anyway, fascinating insight. I mean, it was only half of 1% the official vote.
Yes.
And you're saying that you think it's pretty obvious that there was electoral fraud that would have tipped it over. Do you think that's pretty certain or not?
Well, I mean, you can just do the arithmetic yourself. I mean, if you only have two polling stations in Russia, there were innumerable polling stations in Germany, in Italy, in the United States, in all the other
there
was a Moldovan diaspora, but in Russia, which is home to the largest Moldovan diaspora in the world, there were only two polling stations. Then you just do the arithmetic and say, well, obviously this was fraudulent.
Yeah.
And then this is, there are only 5,000 ballot papers in each of those polling stations, which leaving these Moldovans in Russia disenfranchised. Then you say, well, that result was fraudulent. I mean, it has no connection with reality, and which is why, of course, if you noticed, the EU hasn't exactly been shouting from the rooftops, "Hey, we won in Moldova! We won in Moldova!" They've kind of been keeping low profile about that outcome.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a sneaky one, and they're always going on, of course, about the Russians trying to fix elections. Look, what about Georgia? This is altogether a bit more serious in the Caucasus, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I think it's there's obviously a similarity. I mean, Moldova is vital piece of real estate for NATO, but they have these issues, as I said, with Transnistria and Gagauzia. But with Georgia, also a vital piece of real estate. It's on the east of the Black Sea coast. It's on the Black Sea. But there are issues, conflicts on Georgian territory, South Ossetia, Abkhazia. And there was a war there in 2008 initiated, whether it was encouraged by the Americans, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that it was encouraged by the Americans. as a way to get Georgia into NATO. April 2008 at the Bucharest summit, Ukraine and Georgia promised NATO membership, but the condition for that is that you have to bring to an end the conflicts on your territory. And I think that was the signal for Mikhail Saakashvili, the Georgian president, to try to bring the conflicts on Georgian territory to an end. So he launched this attack on South Ossetia. That ended in disaster for Georgia. Georgia is a small country. Russia was easily able to defeat it. And as a result, Russia then recognized the independence of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. But that experience really was very unfortunate for Georgians. And so Georgia really didn't want to go down this path again. NATO, of course, does want to push Georgia into a conflict with Russia. But Georgians are very reluctant to do so. So that's why the opposition, one party of which is led by Saakashvili, who is now in prison, they are, their agenda is anti-Russian. And so they're obviously supported by the Western powers, who, as I say, would like to open up a second front against Russia. But I think the Georgians, particularly the Georgia Dream Party, is saying, we don't want to go down that path. We don't want to go have another war as we did in 2008. And we certainly don't want to get into a terrible war that Ukraine got into. So the sensible policy for us is to try to maintain good relations both with the West and with Russia. But of course, for the West, that's unacceptable. Hence, they start screaming that there was election fraud, even though, a week has gone by and they haven't been able to produce any evidence at all of election fraud.
Georgia is a bit of a contested place, particularly people like the National Endowment for Democracy, the US State Department, possibly the British Foreign Office, who knows. But there's a big effort, isn't there, and we've seen evidence of this recently, by the Western powers to actually influence politics in Georgia. In other words, to set up their own civil society organizations within Georgia. And the Georgians have, over the last few months, have actually been making real big efforts to ensure that any of these NGOs operating within Georgia are completely transparent about where their money is coming from. Now, this seems to me to be like de rigueur nowadays. In any country that thinks of itself as an independent nation, it needs to know. In fact, you might argue that it should just simply prohibit it. But it needs to know if one of the big superpowers, it could be America, it could be China, is funding political movements within its own country that might bring people out on the streets in protest.
Well, that's exactly right. And the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which was initially passed by the United States in the late 1930s, was done with a view to political organizations that have political influence, having them be transparent about where their money is coming from. And other countries that have adopted variations of that Foreign Agents Registration Act have done it for that purpose. And when you have NGOs, supposed civil society organizations, springing up and lobbying for this, that, and the other, then they should at least be transparent and make clear about their source of money. But in fact, the Georgian legislation was only was actually a very reasonable one. The attorney said if any organization gets more than 20% of its funding from abroad, they should be transparent. So if it's under 20%, then you don't necessarily have to be. So that was it. But the problem in Georgia was that it's been completely inundated by these NGOs. I mean, it's just staggering, the number of them. And all of these NGOs are funded from abroad. And, and then you say, well, why is that? Well, it's because the Western powers want to control Georgia. They want to bring Georgia under control in the days.
Well, you say abroad, but surely they could be Russian-funded NGOs too.
Well, there could be. There's, you know, that absolutely, they could indeed be. But you know, when you have that many, it's unlikely that they're all from Russia. And the fact that essentially it was the Western powers that got so indignant and so upset about this proposed legislation, then, you know, you put two and two together and you think that the Western powers know perfectly well that these organizations, the overwhelming majority of them, if not, you know, 100% of them, are funded from the Western countries. And that's all that was required from this legislation. But it's also a little bit much when you think of how Ursula von der Leyen and all the other characters in the EU are always screaming about Russia this, Russia that, Russia's infecting our, influencing our elections, Russia is controlling our media space, Russia is spreading its poisonous propaganda, but apparently they're not prepared to allow other countries to insist upon transparency. I mean, you know, if you want transparency about supposed Russian influence in Europe, well, why can't Georgians also insist upon transparency about what's going on in Georgia? So apparently we in the West, we can insist on transparency and attack supposed Russian nefarious influence. But heaven forbid if Georgia wants to find out, you know, about influence from abroad. So the West moved in a very intense way at the time of the passage of this legislation, and it seemed for a while that they got their way. So the Georgia Dream, they withdrew the legislation in the face of this pressure, but then they reintroduced it, and this time they held firm, and now it's part of the law in Georgia. So basically, you know, the Western powers have so far failed to bring Georgia to heel, bring Georgia back to the good old days when it was first run by Eduard Shevardnadze, the hapless foreign minister under Gorbachev. He was president, and then he was under Saakashvili. So really, up until relatively recently, Georgia was a pretty reliable Western satellite state.
So we've just had the election there. The ruling party won. They say there's been a lot of fuss about, they saying it was a fixed election, mm-hmm. at least the opposition were, but a partial ballot recount in Georgia's contested parliamentary elections has confirmed the ruling party did win, electoral officials said this week, after the opposition parties had disputed the results. So this opposition, does the EU actually fund the opposition?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's they're obviously, you know, it's kind of whether the political parties are themselves funded by the opposition, by the EU. I'm not sure. What we can surmise is that the protests that are taking place now in Georgia about the supposed election fraud are funded from the EU, and it's clear. You know, you can actually see these interesting items on Twitter or X of these protests by people who have no connection at all from Georgia. You know, they're from Italy or from European countries, and they're holding up signs in English denouncing Russia and interference and, you know, the election fraud. So somebody had to have flown them into Georgia from Europe. So that clearly is being funded from the EU. But the problem they have is that they haven't come up with any evidence that there was any fraud. And this, the president of Georgia, who's really a complete fake. I mean, she's not Georgian. She's a French woman. She was born in France, grew up in France, worked in the French civil service, and was initially appointed French ambassador to Georgia, but was then installed as a Georgian president. So she's basically, you know, the agent of the EU. She's the one who's been going around saying, oh, this was a fraud, this was all Russian operation. But when she's been asked, do you have any evidence for this? She said, well, why should I look for evidence? You know, I'm just a president. It's up to the investigating authorities. It's up to the judicial authorities to come up with evidence. So she's just throwing around these accusations without actually providing any evidence.
Well, it sounds like Georgia is almost like a classic example of modern statecraft right in the middle of this tug of war.
Yes, that's right. I think that's they want to bring Georgia back to the days of, as I said, Shevardnadze and Saakashvili. The West has lost out here. I mean, that's a problem. I mean, the West had Georgia. They had it as a reliably anti-Russian state. They had all these plans in place of bringing Georgia into NATO, and therefore, the Black Sea would become a NATO lake in the way that the Baltic Sea has become a NATO lake. So all these plans were in place until the sort of the debacle of the 2008 war and the gradual move of Georgia out of the orbit of the West, that it just felt that, you know, this is really isn't a good idea for Georgia. Georgia relies on Russia, relies on good relations with Russia, trading relations with Russia. And I think the Georgians just said that this isn't for us. We're being pushed into a conflict with Russia, which is clearly detrimental to our economic and political interests.
Well, I wonder if we in Britain have got something to learn from the Georgians about trying to keep the Americans from interfering in our politics. I've got to ask you about the US elections, George. Do you think there's really anything to call? Obviously, most of the world is wondering and hoping that something will be done about Ukraine and Gaza with these two candidates.
Yeah, I would say that if Harris wins, I don't think anything is going to be done on either Gaza or Ukraine. I think Harris will continue with the Biden policy. I think Harris is very much a creature of the security state, the deep state, whatever. They're going to be set the agenda for her, much as they did with Biden. So I think nothing much will happen. With Trump, you never know. Trump may decide that he wants to be a president for the history books, that he's going to somehow bring peace to the Middle East. That's a tall order, but nonetheless, he has historical ambitions, and it's quite possible that he may decide that it's not in America's interest to go on fighting this war in Ukraine in perpetuity, not in America's interest to have bad relations with Russia. I mean, he thinks China is the big threat to U.S. interests, and if you want to focus on China, it doesn't make sense to drive Russia and China together. So he may, again, it's not a done deal, but it's, he may decide that he needs to bring this war in Ukraine to an end. He promised, repeatedly, that he's going to end this war in 24 hours. So that's a possibility. He also doesn't really want this war hanging over him. He doesn't want to spend the next 4 years messing around in Ukraine, given that it's not really his war. He's just inherited this war from Biden. So, there's a possibility that policy could change with Trump in Ukraine and on Gaza. But who knows? I mean, we saw from his first term that the bureaucracy, foreign policy bureaucracy, the security state, they are very powerful. And, a president may want one thing. The security state may want something else. And if it becomes a confrontation between the two, the security state has a lot of power at his disposal. It can bring a president to his knees. It can help initiate an impeachment process, as it did against Trump. So we'll have to see, but there may well be serious fights between Trump and the security state.
I mean, we've just been talking about the referendum in Moldova, the elections in Georgia, and how secure they are. What about U.S. elections?
I have my doubts. I mean, that it's secure. It's hard to know. I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the problems that emerged in 2020 are still there. I mean, there are all the problems still with the mail-in ballots. the lack of proper signatures, the lack of proper any proper checks as to whom the ballot papers were mailed out to. There are issues about the drop boxes, the security of the drop boxes. So a lot of the problems are still there. And again, also the absentee ballots, you know, who exactly is entitled to vote in an absentee way. People are just going to be, mailing in their votes without any proper check. You know, what it used to be the case that only servicemen abroad can send in their votes, but now an awful lot of people abroad can just simply mail in their votes. And again, with no real checks in place. We also know there's the no checks in place when it comes to IDs. So I don't think the elections are secure. So it's my own view is Trump is ahead. I mean, Trump is clearly the more popular of the two candidates. However, the Democrats are absolute masters of stealing an election that they've lost. And I think
that's funny. It's very similar. The 2020 election was quite similar to the one that you're describing in Moldova, where it looked as if it was going one way, and then it's almost like at midnight, suddenly the vote switches in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, that's what happened. You know, as you recall, in 2020, you know, was in Pennsylvania. Trump was 800,000 votes ahead, and there's just no way he can lose in Pennsylvania. And then they suddenly kept finding elections, and it happened in Georgia as well. So, we'd been led to believe that somehow those issues have been resolved. I'm not at all convinced that they've been resolved, and we're again getting these rulings, these strange rulings from the courts, whereby you can go on counting votes that come in days after the polls close, and indeed you can go on counting votes that come in without even the postmark. Mysteriously show up and go on counting.
I mean, maybe they should have Chinese and Russians in there just checking on their elections for them.
I think so. I mean, I absolutely think so. I mean, if you had elections anywhere in the world that the United States has, you know, you would have, you know, observers saying this is not a free and fair election. I mean, there's just so much that is obviously ripe for fraud that we just can't take seriously these announced election results. I mean, then
amazing. Finally, George, we're going to talk about Ukraine a bit and Kursk, what's happening there. We've heard the North Koreans are coming in, but it would have seemed to me that really not long after it started, the Russians quite possibly could have removed the Ukrainians from Kursk, and there might be all sorts of other reasons why the Russians don't necessarily want to remove the Ukrainian pocket straight away. I think it's feasible to cut it off, to cut off their supplies, cut off their food, make it difficult for them in Kursk. And I wonder whether this might form part of a deal. In other words, the Kursk land is returned by Ukraine, you know, in the future in exchange for peace. Who knows? But what do you make of what's been going on in Kursk and also the future for Zelensky?
Well, I think it's very hard to know. And I think it goes back to what we were talking about a moment ago. I think the only thing that matters now is the U.S. election. I think that's going to be more important than anything going on the ground in Kursk and in Ukraine. In other words, who's going to take over in Washington? Because I think if Trump takes over, then I think there's going to be some moves towards some kind of a settlement, a deal. It'll only be, I think, a partial deal somehow to bring the fighting to an end and freeze the conflict and so on. You know, and that may involve some withdrawal from Kursk, maybe some Russian withdrawals in exchange. So something along those lines. If it isn't Trump, if Harris takes over, I think Harris escalates the war, and then I think Russia would have to make a serious decision about bringing this war to an end, and therefore undertaking a major mobilization. In other words, they have to just apply much more force than they have, in order, because otherwise this could go on for years, and I don't see that this is in any way in Russia's interest to let this war drag on for another year, 2 years, 3 years. So then I think Russia would have to make this decision. I think the Russians are looking for the U.S. election and seeing, how that's going to turn out. And then they will make their strategic decision on the basis of who takes over in Washington. And I think if there's a major mobilization, then I think they could just bring this war to an end. In other words, they're going to make use of their greatly superior manpower and just end it. But I think if it's Trump, then there's a possibility that some kind of a deal could be struck.
But this arrival of the North Korean troops is a bit of a rabbit out of the hat. Or at least that's the way I saw it.
Yeah, but there's, we're talking about a very small number. We're talking about 10,000, 12,000. I don't think it's not going to make much of a difference. And I doubt whether these North Koreans, Koreans haven't fought a war in 70 years, whether you can just throw them into this crucible, without any real experience. They don't know the terrain. They don't, the nature of war has changed a great deal, with drones and so on. So I don't think they'll be of any use in the conflict. I think maybe it's a psychological boost, a political boost, but and I think more significantly, I think it's much more beneficial to the North Koreans, because what they've now accomplished, why I think it's more of a political move than anything else, is that the Russian-North Korean partnership is a strategic partnership. So if North Korea gets involved in some kind of a war on the Korean Peninsula, Russia will be obligated to come to North Korea's assistance. And I think that's the more significant part of this arrival of the North Koreans. I don't think they're going to make any difference fighting. I don't think they're going to do any fighting, because they just, they don't have any fighting experience. They don't know this terrain. They don't know modern warfare. So I don't think that's not significant. What is significant is that this partnership between Russia and North Korea is really quite a serious one. And I think the Americans now have realized that if you mess with North Korea, suddenly you're going to have a confrontation with Russia on your hands.
Well, yeah. Right. Well, I think that's what seems to be what they want. Also, it's it's good, useful live fire training for the North Koreans. It also sends a very, very, very direct message to both South Korea and the United States about North Korea's readiness to fight. Anyway, look, George, fascinating. Thanks for all that. But if listeners are interested in following you, I know you do quite a few fairly regular podcasts, interviews, and things on YouTube, etc. Right. Where can people find
you? That's right. We have a which is The Gaggle, GAGGLE at locals.locals.com. So we have a Locals. We're also on YouTube. So we post our podcasts on YouTube, but Locals, our Locals channel is great. So please subscribe to us on our Locals channel. You can follow me also on Twitter, on X, and you can also follow me on Substack. And yesterday I addressed the UN Security Council, so you can go to the UN page and you can still listen to me addressing the UN Security Council, if you're interested in that.
Well, that's a biggie to drop in at the last minute, George. What was that about?
That was about Ukraine and NATO enlargement, basically how the NATO enlargement provoked the war in Ukraine.
Fascinating. Well, I'll post a link to that. I'll have a look, find it, and post a link for our listeners.
So it's yesterday, October the 31st. So you know, you go to the UN page, you'll see it.
George Samueli, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.